sense. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it's only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. Our speaker tonight is from Triangle, and I just met him before the meeting, but he seems like a nice guy. So I give you Ted.
Everybody, I'm Ted, and I am an alcoholic. And by the grace of God in this program, I haven't seen fit to take a drink since September 28th of 1993. I don't say that there's any merit in that time, but it has been something that for so long in my life I could not see living without drinking. And now I think that I can have at least enough perspective that I understand that I can live without drinking. There was a time when drinking was a necessity. When the book talks about my best friend talks about something that goes out and turns and cuts you to ribbons. And a very short sentence is my story. Now, I talk funny. I'm from Atlanta. And if y'all aren't from Atlanta, I may sound a little bit funny. And I promise there are people here that can translate what I'm saying into wherever you're from. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was born in Atlanta, not too far from here. Two parents who had met during the Second World War. My father was an Atlanta native. He was a decorated World War II combat veteran from the European theater. He was a war hero. He met my mother when he was in recovery from a war wound. They got married, came back to Atlanta, and set up shop. My mother was from Ashland, Kentucky. She was the third generation off the boat from Ireland. They knew how to drink and how to roll steel in Ashland. And my dad knew how to be an Atlanta blue blood. And so it was an interesting family to grow up in. As I grew up, there were a couple of things that happened. First off, I found out as a child that it was real, real hard to please my dad. And the second thing I found out, it was real, real hard to understand where my mom was going to be coming from on a day-to-day basis. And so as a child, I learned how to read the room very, very quickly. And I was able to pick up on what the mood was in the room, what the temperament was going to be in my parents, how to avoid getting in trouble or how to get in trouble as the case may be. But it was very, very inconsistent. Now, I had great parents. They educated me. They fed me. They clothed me. They made sure I had medical attention. They provided a good house for me. I didn't become an alcoholic because I had bad parents. I didn't have an alcoholic because I came from that much of a troubled childhood or a troubled life. I became an alcoholic because I liked to drink, and I drank a lot. Now, my first experiment, a few other things. My grandfather, he ran a dance hall down over off Wyuka Road. It used to be out in the country. And every Saturday night, they'd bring in 1,000 couples and a big band, and he'd set up everybody with chips and mixers, and they'd bring their own bottles, and it'd be a big party. And so as a child, I worked in that dance hall, cleaning tables, working in the kitchen, and things of that nature. I could make from 10 to 20 bucks a night. It was a lot of fun to have pocket change as a child, and those dances were fun. But I also remember the Sundays after those dances, after everybody had left, the smells. Smells of whiskey and cigarette butts, some smells of regret, some smells of fun. And so drinking was part of our family. It was part of where we were. There were no prohibitions in my family about drinking or partying or things of that nature. That was just a part of life. So as I got a little bit older, I decided that I'd take my first drink. So at 13, I got in my dad's liquor cabinet and poured myself a screwdriver. My older sister had shown me what a screwdriver was, and so I had a screwdriver, and I drank, and it didn't do a damn thing. I said, well, hell, this vodka doesn't do anything for me. I can drink this stuff no problem at all. So I had me another. Nothing happened. So that sowed a seed that I was somewhat immune to the effects of alcohol. Now, it was just in the last 6 months I found out that my sister had been watering that vodka bottle. First trick. So I got a little bit further along in the thing, and I think I did what I considered, at least for somebody my age, some normal adolescent drinking. I got out, got drunk a few times, threw up a few times, said, okay, you know, I got this thing under control. I understand what I'm doing. And then around my senior year in high school, I had what I call my first spiritual experience. I'd met a man in a group and came to a faith, came to the understanding of a power greater than myself, and it meant a lot to me. And for whatever reason, at that point in time, drinking and partying and things of that nature seemed to fall away, and I found a pretty good way of life. And I held on to that way of life as a senior in high school and as a freshman in college. But on my 18th birthday, my dad took me out for a steak dinner. We went to Valley Steakhouse. If any of y'all from here remember Valley's down on Cleveland, down on 75. And my dad said, I'll have a Jack and Seven, and I said, I'll have one too. And so I sat down and I had a Jack and Seven, and I got that warm feeling and that glow that life was A-okay. And I said, where had you been? And I remember that drink tonight as well as when it happened. I found something that worked. Coming up, I was one of these kids. I had to try hard at everything that I did. If I couldn't do well, I'd tear it up. If I worked on a model and couldn't get it perfect, I'd tear the thing up. If I worked on a project and couldn't get it perfect, I'd tear it up. And I would just seethe with rage if I couldn't get it right. Most of the time, I could keep that under control. But there were times when it popped out. Once again, the book teaches me that I drank because I have a mental obsession. And that mental obsession is my committee. And that committee goes on today as it went on then. And at some point in time, one of those committee members says, it's okay to take a drink. And once I take that drink as an alcoholic, the insanity goes into motion because my physical craving occurs. Well, anyway, that committee had already gotten itself some roots in my life, even as a teenager and even as a young adult. And when I found that booze, I said, wow, I can turn that committee off and I can feel okay within my own skin. And so I said, I need to keep doing this. And so I did. And I found that when I drank, I would drink to excess. And so I'd say, well, I'm not going to do that. And so my periods of drinking went from doing it once a year, to doing it once every 9 months, to doing it once every 6 months, to doing it once every 3 months, until for me, I became a daily drinker. And so I would get up in the morning. I can honestly say I never missed a day of work while I was drinking. Never missed a day of work. I went to work hungover, half drunk a few times, loaded up on coffee, feeling like hell, and at 3:30, after swearing that morning I would never drink again, at 3:30 I'd get that little taste in the back of my throat. It wasn't quite that bad last night. Maybe I could do that again. And so that became my routine. My routine was I'd get up, I'd work hard. 5 o'clock, drinking light comes on. Drink until I pass out. Wake up the next morning, do it again. In the last several years of my drinking, that's where it was. Now, drinking for me wasn't always fun. I can tell you for a fact I had some good times drinking. I think that there are times when alcohol saved my life. Early on, I had some modest business success. Had a little money in my pocket. Things were going well. Had money to do pretty much whatever I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. But I got myself into a jam and started to get a little depressed. And so one afternoon, for whatever reason, I had a family then. And I thought that the only thing that a man like me could do that had so much pride as I do, and one of the points I think that I hope you hear out of this point, is that all the way to that last drink, I still had my pride. Okay? In spite of all the evidence to the contrary, I still had my pride. And so my pride was that I had to provide for my family. My pride was that I had to provide for an image. I had to have an image about myself and an image about my family, an image about everything around me. And so I kept this image all the way out here. You were not going to see me inside of this image, but I was going to keep this image here. And so at the end, that image began to fall apart like an old tile bathroom. I was working desperately trying to stick the tiles back up. So in 83, 10 years before finding the program, that image was, in my own mind, was crumbling, and so I decided suicide was a good idea. So I've been drinking Tanqueray gin. Anybody ever drink Tanqueray gin? Maybe once or twice. It might be one or two there. I love the smell of those pine needles. Those little pine needles smell really, really good. And so I would sit there and I'd have those gins and tonic and things of that nature. And so I decided, well, you know, man of my means and man of my pride, the only way for me to provide my family is all my insurance policy for now in effect and all my suicide clauses. And last night, I just shoot myself. And so I cleaned my pistol. I said, before I kill myself, I'm going to take myself a couple of drinks. So I did. And I took a couple of more. And then I took a couple of more, and then I passed out. And I didn't shoot myself, obviously. I woke up after that, and I said, damn, I almost shot myself. I've got to quit. I got to quit drinking gin. That was the end of the gin experiment. Gin will make you want to kill yourself. At least it did me. I only got drunk on blueberry liqueur once. I'd run out for whatever reason. I'd run out, and the only thing I could find was some blueberry liqueur that my wife had bought to make some sort of cake. That was a nasty, nasty drunk. But it worked, and it's what I had to do. That's what I had to do to survive. There were some times hilarious. I was out in San Diego on a convention one time with my wife. We were at one of these high-end auctions to where they trot out the trips and the games and everything, and you bid on them, and I've been drinking a lot. And so in between acting outrageously and bidding outrageous numbers, and thankfully there were other people who were more outrageous than me, I decided that I was getting sick, and so I went outside to throw up. And I got on a loading dock outside of this convention center. I leaned over to throw up in a dumpster, promptly fell in. And I didn't get too much on my shoes. And so I'm sitting there in a dumpster with a suit and a tie on, and I'm going, well, I guess I got to climb out of here. And so I climbed out. So what did any good alcoholic, what did this good alcoholic do? Went back to that convention. By God, I went back to that table and poured me another drink. Because that's how I survived. That's how I got by. There were other times I came in early one day. I always said, I'll never miss work. Except if it was, let's see, well, I don't want to say that, but I didn't mind drinking on holidays. I didn't mind drinking on Saturdays and Sundays and things of that nature, so those work days started to get a little shorter, too. But I was in the office one morning about 6:30, 7 o'clock, and I had a fellow that was working for me that came in, and he wanted to go over some things. And so I'm sitting there, and, you know, I'd had a little bit too much to drink the night before, and I had a little indigestion. And so I leaned over to kind of get rid of some of that gas that I thought had built up. It was a little more solid than gas. And so as we're sitting there in that meeting and I'm feeling that wonderful substance roll down the back of my legs, and I'm talking to him, and he's talking to me, and I said, I hope this son of a bitch can't smell. And so he wanted to talk, and I wanted him to leave. And he kept on talking, and thank God he finally left. And I called my wife, and I said, you got to bring me some clean clothes. And so I sat there for the next 20 minutes, and then I had to get cleaned up and do it again. But that's just what, you know, that was life. You know, I had the flu. I had a little flu. I had a little case of the stomach flu. Wasn't that I had too much to drink the night before. Another thing I was bad to do there is I was bad to celebrate in advance of the win. So if I thought I was going to have a success on Thursday, well, Tuesday would be a perfect day to start partying over my Thursday success that was to come. Or I could start on Wednesday for the Friday disappointment that was going to come. But I always figured out that if I could just get some alcohol in me, that I'd change the way that I felt. Because I never liked the way I felt, and alcohol changed the way I felt. What does any of that mean? I think all it means is that I was an alcoholic. When I look at the medical facts, I did those things that alcoholics do. I could take those damn little tests that they have, where if you check so many of these boxes, you've got an alcoholic problem. If there were 7 you had to check, I wanted to get 6. I didn't ever want to do that stuff because I didn't want to admit that I was not at home. Now, another thing that happened that was a blessing to me is that we had a lot of alcoholics in my family. I had a great uncle that I watched die of liver failure at the VA hospital over when it was over on Peachtree Road. It was not pretty. On my mother's side, we were full alcoholics on my mother's side. Many of them died too. And there were plenty of admonitions in my family about not becoming alcoholic. But their idea of not becoming alcoholic was to not let anybody know that you were an alcoholic. So they had a little ditty that they used to say. They say, he is not drunk from whence the floor can rise again to drink once more. He is drunk though who prostrate lies can neither drink nor rise. So when the idea of being an alcoholic is up here, well, once you get to here, you can always lower your standards just a little bit more. And so my definition of being an alcoholic kept going down, and it kept going down. So that was my drinking. We got up to the end, got up to the May before the program found me, or I found the program. I was in South Carolina with some friends doing blackout drinking, came out of a blackout on a South Carolina road singing at the top of my lungs, "We Won't Get Fooled Again" by The Who with my buddies. Lost a night. Another night lost. Didn't know where I'd been. Didn't know what I'd done. I was glad I was in the back seat and not driving. My family had, by that time, had kind of gotten sick of listening to me. And so they were in the avoidance mode. They could get Daddy home from work, and they could get him with enough in him to where he'd pass out. They knew that they wouldn't have to listen to my lectures, my rages, or my romantic sentimentality. And so one Sunday afternoon in September, Braves were playing. My wife had left, taking the kids. I was trying to get drunk on beer, which is a little bit, for me at that time, was a little bit like trying to start a fire with wet matches. I seemed to get more bloated, and I couldn't get drunk, and I couldn't get sober. And so I was sitting there in the kitchen, and my daughter had been going to a church up the way, and there was a program there for that church, and I turned over on the back of that particular bulletin from that church, and there was a statement or a line there says Alcoholics Anonymous meets at 6:30 on Wednesdays. And clear as a bell, a voice said to me, "You need to try that." I don't know where that voice came from, and I sure don't want to sound hokey. But I think I've heard from the Master a couple of times in my life, and I think that was one of them. And so at that point I said, "I'm going to go to that AA meeting." I knew about AA because some of my relatives had been involved in AA, but I didn't know exactly what this deal was about. But I knew I had a pretty strong suggestion from somebody a little bit outside of myself that I maybe ought to try that deal. And so I went to this service, and I went to this AA meeting at this here church that I went to. And I walked in, and there were 10 or 12 people there. And it was the first meeting that they were having for that AA group at that church ever. And so I sat around, there were people talking about being an alcoholic, and I looked at them and I said, "Well, they don't look too much like me," because, you know, I had put on my coat and tie, and I looked good when I went in. I also used an acronym for my name. I didn't say that I was Ted, I said, "I'm TR, and I think I drink too much, I might have a problem." And so I listened to these folks, and one of the old guys that was there, he took me aside afterwards. He says, "Well, how do you drink?" I said, "I got a problem." He says, "All you got is a problem drinking?" I said, "Yeah, I got a problem." He says, "Well, man, you need to go drink some more until you understand you're an alcoholic." And I said, "I don't think that's very compassionate of you to speak to me that way." And he said, "You need to come to this meeting on Thursday with me." And so he invited me to a meeting on Thursday. And I didn't have the benefit of a treatment center. And I'm all for treatment centers, and I'm all for what treatment centers bring, but I was too damn proud to go to a treatment center. Because my family, you do not ask for help. Okay? Asking for help is a sign of weakness. You handle your own problems. Son, if you're hurt, you rub dirt on it. Okay? When the coach said, "Play through pain," I believe that guy. Okay? There's a difference between pain and injury. I understood that. You play hurt. Okay? You don't admit you're an alcoholic. By God, that's a sign of weakness. here are people trying to help me. I didn't know I'd trust you folks. But you didn't ask me for money. And you didn't ask me to cite a creed. And you didn't ask me to do anything but just hang out with you. And you took me to meetings and you suggest that I went. And so I went. So early on, I'm going to meetings for a couple of weeks. I'm clearing up a little bit. I'm not drinking. That was a miracle in and of itself. And all of a sudden, the terror started to hit. Started to feel again. All my anesthesia was gone. Started having panic attacks. So I got the sponsor. Suggested you get a sponsor. Suggested you do 90 meetings in 90 days. I was willing to try for 90 days. I figured I could do anything for 90 days. So I got this sponsor. He had to be a bartender. He had to have a pony. He had a big ponytail, which I thought was pretty interesting. So I got the most, in terms of, you know, somebody that I thought didn't look like me, that's who I wanted as my sponsor. Because I figured if I get somebody that weird, okay, maybe I can get out of this deal. There was always that balance. But that guy, he said, look, here's what you need. You need to do service work. And so the next night we went down to Atlanta Union Mission. And so he had me down at Atlanta Union Mission as often as they had a meeting down there. He had me at Shepherd's House down on Bolton. He had me at every meeting that he could bring me to because he said, you are nothing but a buckhead boy. You don't understand what this disease will do to you. You need to go do service work. And so we did service work. Service work was, how about getting that guy a cup of coffee? Oh, you mean I don't have to set up a treatment center and save the world? No. Get him a cup of coffee. Say hello to the stranger. Put your hand down. Say hello. He taught me I'm not different. He taught me I'm alike. He taught me that I'm like other alcoholics. I'm not special. I'm average. I got pride, but I don't have to have false pride. I can be who I am, and you can be who you are, and I can respect you for that. And you can respect me for that. And we can walk this road together, although our past may be totally different and our backgrounds may be totally different. The leveling influence of alcoholism allows us to walk this road together. That was a big revelation for me. Now, the other thing that hit was this whole God business. Now, the God business for me up to that point was you had to be theologically correct. I've had theological training. I believed a certain way. And if you didn't believe the way I believed, you were not right. Okay? And it was my job to tell you you were wrong. And let me tell you why you are wrong. That's where I came from. I'm not saying that makes sense. That's just saying where I was. And so early on in the program, I had to drop all my theology. And for me, the only name I could give God early on in the program was the sobriety God. And so I learned to pray to the sobriety God that kept me sober. Now coming back around after 20 years, I've been able to attach other words and other names to that power greater than myself. But now instead of God doing my bidding, hopefully I'm learning how to do a little bit more of His. While I was drinking, God was my agent. If I said a prayer, it was where I could get my way. I would have good or bad alternatively so that I could manipulate my higher power to give me what I wanted. That was part of my pride. I was my own God. I wanted to be king. What I found out is that I couldn't get sober as king. I couldn't get sober as God. The only way that I could do it was with folks who are alcoholics like me. That's not a bad gig. So what's the last 20 years been like? The last 20 years has been like on life's terms. There have been some great times. There have been some terrible times. I have two kids. One, my oldest is 34 now. My youngest is 32. My 32-year-old son, during the course of this program, we had to kick him out of the house and let him be homeless for a while. That wasn't an easy thing to do. But it's what we had to do. Because that's what he needed to have those consequences to where he could make an appropriate choice. He had to live out his consequences. My daughter, who's the apple of my eye, got married. She's had three boys. I've got three grandsons, 8, 6, 4 at this point. They come over to the house regularly. It's fun. We sit down, we talk, we have a good time together. I can enjoy it. You know, I don't really care what they are or what they're going to be. I'm proud to have them in my life. It's fun to be able to participate in those sort of things. There have been some tough times, too. I had a period in 2005 and 2006 where I had a severe case of depression. Clinically diagnosed depression. The world got black over my head. And all I could see was a little bit of light, just like this. And guys like Big Fred and others who y'all probably know from NABA were there to walk through me. The best I could do at that point in time after a number of years of sobriety was to come sit in my chair. I couldn't talk. I couldn't interact. But I could sit in my chair. And the fellows in this program, my sponsor, friends, they made sure that I stayed safe during that period of time. They would come see me at work. They would take me out to dinner. They would make sure that I made my appointments with folks outside of the program. And I do believe that often it's necessary to get outside help outside of the program. But everybody, you know, they drug me. They helped me. And that's what I found here. 2 years ago, my dad died. He was obviously a big force in my life. Interesting situation, you know. When he died, he made sure that things were up in the air because that's the way he lived his life. But my sisters and I had total peace about that whole deal. We never had a cross word. In fact, we haven't had a cross word since he's died. There were things to be disposed of. There were things to be taken care of, and we handled it just like brothers and sisters should. That wasn't the case when I came into the program. Through my 4-step and 5th step, I was able to see God in my sponsor, and then by seeing God in my sponsor, I was able to see God in other people and then see God outside of the program. I don't know if any of y'all have done a 5-step yet, but I do remember my 5th step when I got to the secrets. And so when I sat down with my sponsor, started throwing them a few easy ones, I'm resentful at the IRS because I have to pay taxes and things of that nature. And so, but then I got to the secrets. And I've never met an alcoholic yet that does not have secrets. And they don't have parts of their life that they don't want to talk about. And when I got to that point, I started to share those things with that sponsor. He got a tear in his eye. He said, I did exactly the same thing. I thought he was going to reject me. When I got to that secret, I said, well, he's going to leave now. Didn't happen. What does one do with that as an alcoholic? When you find out that there's more forgiveness than I'm willing to be asked, than I'm willing to ask for. God's more willing to forgive me than I'm willing to ask. You folks in the program are more willing to forgive me than I'm willing to ask. You're willing to give more to me than I'll give to you. That's how it works for me. So, garden variety drunk. Currently, I try to be sure that in terms of maintenance, 10, 11, and 12 are important for me. I believe in prayer and meditation. I believe that's an important part of the program. I think it's important to develop a habit of that. Whether you do or don't, that's your business, but it works for me. I still regularly attend meetings. I sponsor people. I have a good time in the program. I enjoy doing what I'm doing. Tim said he wanted me to talk until quarter till. I can't talk that long. But I don't know what the format is. Tim, you can correct me, but I'd love to hear what y'all have to say because y'all keep me sober. So with that, I'll open it up. Anybody got anything? Yes, sir.
I was an awesome fan to hear.
Yeah,
what? I've got many years. I've got many drugs and alcohol to do. I appreciate talking about sponsor, bonding with my sponsor too. This dude, he was like 6'4". It looked like he was a guy of brawn with a beard in the Pocono Mountains, and nicest guy I ever met. You know, and we went to when we did went to many meetings. We did I read Living Sober with him. We did Come to Believe. We did the old timers, all books, the AA books, man. It was, Pass It On. That was one of my favorite books. I really liked all that, you know, and it was really, really, it really helped me out meeting a sponsor, somebody to bond. I don't bond with people. As a matter of fact, that lady told me I had an innate way of pissing people off. I'm a little bit better than that, thanks. Yeah,
thank you. Yes, sir.
I found it really interesting what you were saying about your period of depression, because I've suffered from some of that too, and there's times when I can feel it coming on, you know, and I kind of fight my way out of it. I'd just be interested to hear what, you know, how you were feeling when that all started happening. Mm-hmm. Was it an event, or was it just a gradual thing that just happened, or just, I really have to
go in the yard. Yeah, I call depression that old black dog that comes nipping at my heels from time to time. My situation was that I had some events in my life that were stressors. Not to sound overly clinical, but I had some things happen that got my mind going and got me racing. And at that point, the depression set in. And so I have to be on guard for getting myself into situations that have too much pressure associated with them. When I do, I have to be talking about it before I get in and be sure that I've got all the support mechanisms in place before I wade in too far. I still like to charge hard. I still enjoy that. But I don't think I can take every mountain anymore. Yeah. Yes, sir.
I'm talking
about the
holidays.
Hey, Joe.
I heard you say the part about where you got there and you start to feel things. And that's kind of where I'm at. You know, I'm usually going from 0 to 100. Everything else in between is a mystery. and now it's like, you know, I'm going through the whole range of emotions. And how do you deal with that?
Okay. That's a good question. I'll tell you a story. I like to tell stories if you haven't figured that out yet. But I was sitting there in my office one day, and all of a sudden I started having a panic attack. I didn't know it was a panic attack. And I started breathing. And, you know, I was like this, and I'd get a little jumpy. We had these phones that had lights on. The phones were lighting up. I was worried somebody was going to call me because I couldn't talk. I was doing like this. And so I'd been around the program long enough that I knew I'd call my sponsor. So I called my sponsor and I said, "Dick, I said, man, I never felt like this before. I'm jumpy, I'm, you know, hyperventilating, I'm, you know, think the world's getting ready to come to an end. What's going on?" He says, "Oh, you're just having a panic attack." I said, "Well, easy for you to say." He says, "Practice a little deep breathing." And so he proceeded the next few minutes to take me through some breathing exercises. Breathe in, breathe out, breathe in. Out. And we did that for a while. He said, "Now, go shut your door and turn off your phone for a bit. And just get yourself all back together. Give me a call in about 10 minutes. So I did that. 10 minutes later, this thing had passed. What that taught me was that when I started to get uncomfortable in my own skin, the first thing I needed to do is that I needed to pick up that phone. And I needed to talk to my sponsor about it. And I needed to let him know how I was feeling. Because my feelings weren't rational, okay? They didn't necessarily make sense. I could walk into a Burger King and alternatively love and hate the French fry maker at the same time, okay? I could walk into an AA meeting and have a young person in it, and I got, damn it, they got here early. They got here before me, and then I'd look at some old timer, that son of a bitch got to drink longer than me. And I'd be mad at both of them at the same time. That's not rational. It's the way I felt. And so I had to express those things. I had to talk to somebody about it. Because I had to get a new frame of reference. I had to be able to differentiate between what was sometimes a physiological reaction, what was a psychological reaction, and what was a spiritual reaction. Just for me, I had to do that. I kind of look at it this way. If we're sitting here together and I pull out of my back pocket, if I pull out a big snake and throw it at your feet, you're probably going to jump in your chair. If you find out it's a plastic snake, you're going to say, that guy tricked me. But, you know, from a physiological side, all that stuff gets dumped in your system and you're going to be jacked up for a while. And it takes time for that to come back off. So sometimes I get myself physiologically worked up about something and the chemistry's just there. And until I take time to let that stuff process through, I'm not going to calm down, no matter what I'm thinking. And that's where a sponsor gets in. Does that help? Yes, sir. Hey, Stephen.
Come to these meetings and hearing people talk with you, you know, making me feel like I'm not the only one. I'm not pride and ego, like I'm not one to, you know, to someone just tell my story like you did, you know. I grew up in my family with my dad, like, you know, you cry, you're weak. You ask for help, you're weak. 10 years later, here I am. Every time I ask him for help, he's just like, you know, he finally understands who I am. And it feels good for you, for like a family state. And I wish things were different back then. But, yeah, I've done what you did, you know. Try to shoot myself, hang myself, tell my mom, just testing how strong my rope was. When I wake up, you know. But it's sickening, you know. Mm-hmm. I do what he did.
Thanks. Now, you know, on the family side, yeah, I don't think my family, it's good when your family can, all the way around, can be good. But I was about 10 years in, and I was sitting with my dad. My dad says, you still going to them there AA meetings? And I went, yeah, I still am. He said, you know, when are you going to get well? And I said, it's okay, Pop. You're never going to get it. And he never did. He never did get it. Until his dying day, he didn't get it. But you know what? He didn't have to get it. I had to get it. Yes, sir.
My name's Tim. I'm not the
father. Hey, Tim.
Yeah, I'm still concerned with losing your father. I lost mine a couple of years ago. And he was my go-to. You know, he raised me, my two brothers. You know, so to lose him, it took a lot out of me. You know, so I kind of like fucked him, you know. And I still have a shelter, you know. I still kind of fucked him, like that, you know. Now I'm trying to work on it. You know, when you lose the source, I mean, I have my sponsor tell me, hey, you got to open up, you got to let it out. And I know I can, some kind of way. Because even at the film, I was too shocked to cry. You know, he always thought to be suffering, like Dad said. You don't cry, you know what I'm saying? You know, the men cry in the dark, you know, it's the way they feel out, you know. And, right now I'm trying, you know. And I just, I got going, whatever they say, I think. My dad was a strong man, so if he raised three boys, I know I can do it.
Thank you, appreciate that. Yes, ma'am. Hey, Margaret.
I'm really identifying with keeping secrets. And I can't really identify with keeping secrets. That seems to be an Irish trait. Don't tell. Don't call yourself an alcoholic. And my mother used to say, if you're going to cry, go outside. The relief of telling on myself, the relief of just being, and you know, coming into AA meetings every day and crying if I want to, and just letting go of the good feeling.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
My name is Giovanni. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Giovanni.
When you were talking about that image, you got to pretend, let other people think that what's going on with you, but inside is something else. But I think that's where I'm at. Because it's really hard to hear, talk about my feelings, even with my sponsor. woman, the man feel good in the beginning, you know, when things started happening, and I feel like I'm in the middle of the world. In the middle of the world, like they were saying in the meeting the other day, where, you know, the program works as long as you do what they tell you. But I'm at that point where, you know, I'm willing to do this and this and this, but maybe not this, maybe not that. That's not how it works. It's in this point blank. With this program, it's just one way, and it's the right way. There's no around it, there's no, you want to know here, she don't test, but there's no test. You know what I mean? And you know, I really feel like shit. Like, I'm full of language, you know. You know, I was going through certain things, and you know, everything's going the way I expect, right? Now things are not going the way Giovanni wants, or the way Giovanni expects. See, and all these feelings and all these emotions started coming, and I already told you, if I don't do these things, I'm going to end up in the same place where I was before. But I, you know, I'm at the point where I know what I got to do. See, it's not like before. I used to just let it be, and eventually I just did what I wanted to go and use and numb the feelings. See, I guess that's the beauty of this, that now I've got a choice. But it's hard to make that choice, the right choice, because it's not what I want. You know, it's you know, what I want is all the things, and God's will is not what it is. You know, I know I got to call my sponsor. You know, I know I got to avoid certain things in life. People, places. And that's one the big issue is that I got this phone number from this person. It's a female issue. And I got a wife, you know. And I'm trying to make things work. And now, something happened. I got the number from this old female, and I know I shouldn't be calling her. I haven't called her, only for one, trying to get my stuff back before I went to prison. And, you know, I'm in a way, I'm trying to get a job, and she got my birth certificate and my social security number, but I'm already where I'm trying to look for something else, you know. And I already know it was a sick relationship. Because of that, I got into an argument with my wife, and she even said, don't even call me back anymore. She didn't even know about this. It's just, I was trying to explain to her how this works, and she got really offended about, you know, the groups. And I was, you know, in my sick mind, I'm like, damn, this opportunity to break up with her. Now I don't even got to cheat on her. You know, I can just do it the right way. You know, now I'm free. Now I can actually do it the right way. You know, and it's incredible. You know, I definitely agree with what people keep saying, that, you know, if you keep coming back, it'll matter how much time you have, because when everything is good, you know, you're fine. But when things are going bad, you gotta be ready for this. You know, you still fear. You're still going to go through emotions. Things going to happen. It's not going to get perfect. It's like my dad said. When you first come in, it's very, very good. And then it gets very good. And then, I mean, real, real good. And it gets real good. And then it gets real. See what I mean? And, you know, I got some extra hard bullshit. You know? So I'm definitely not going to go and use that.
Yeah, you know, one thing that I really did enjoy that my sponsor did with me a lot early on is that he helped me to practice doing things that were right. I had a situation where I didn't know how to go to a business meeting without having a cocktail. You know, how do you go out to dinner with business people and not drink? That didn't make any sense, you know, that you would not drink. And so he said, man, you don't know how to do that. We need to go practice. So he would pick me up, and we would go out, and we would go into a restaurant. And he would look at the head, the waitress or the maitre d', and he goes, "Hey, my buddy here is an alcoholic. But I choose not to drink today. You ain't damn sure he doesn't have anything to drink." I'm going, "Hey, these people aren't going to think something. Because these people give a shit what you think. They don't care anything about you." And he would embarrass me, poke me, but he showed me how I could go out and have dinner and not drink. Now, that's kind of socially how burned I was coming into this deal, that I had to have practice in going out and learning how to eat again. I think that any time I've had a tough situation, that there's always been a sponsor, a good friend in the program that will go with me. And I don't mean mentally. I'm talking physically. If I'm putting myself in harm's way, I better have somebody with me. And when it comes to some issues, especially related to the opposite sex, I know absolutely positively that there are certain things that I don't need to do alone. Because I get on the back of that camel, and I'm going to fall off because I can't stop. And so I just better not get there. But you do what you want to do. You know, but you don't have to do the deal alone. Is that it? Tim, thank you all very much for keeping me sober.
We'll all be together on that broad highway.